In 2016, people gathered to protest construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline in and around the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. In the coming months, the encampment would swell to thousands of Indigenous people and non-Native relatives. The governor of North Dakota activated the National Guard as the pipeline battle played out in federal court. National news organizations reported on the standoff and on alleged police violence against the water protectors. Teresa Zeglowitz was there. She was a teacher at what was known in English as the Defenders of the Water School. She's also a poet. Her new poetry collection is out now. It's called Something Small of How to See a River. She stopped by our SDPB studios in Sioux Falls.
I lived on the Rosebud Reservation for a little bit over 3 years in around 2007.
Teaching?
I was a teacher and really loved my students. It was really, really special, really beautiful. And then when the camp started at Standing Rock, the Ocheti Shakoi camp, to protect the water against the Dakota Access Pipeline, I came up to just deliver some donations and spend a few days, and then met my friend Elena Eagleshield, who was starting a school at the camp, and she invited me to come stay, and I helped and taught there for a little while, and kept thinking I was going to leave and go back to grad school. And it was so beautiful. It was such an incredible space and so incredible to be involved in this type of learning that was so community-based, so movement-based, so much about what the kids needed and families wanted and community wanted. And so I ended up staying there.
So what kind of donations did you bring up in the first place? I want to go back to the early days, because now we know so much about this camp.
Yeah.
But at the very beginning, when you first arrived, what was it?
Yeah. Well, I came in August, so the camp was already really going, right? I brought some books because I had heard that there was something happening with a school. So I brought books, some food. I can't even remember.
What did you expect?
I didn't really know what to expect. I had a few people I knew, up there. So I had kind of been in touch with people. But also, I remember what you were seeing on the news at that time, with the roads being closed. And it was so clear that the state of North Dakota was trying to send this really scary message about what was happening, I sort of didn't know, but I said, okay, I'm gonna just go and see. And I got there, and in August, before there was really, there was not a lot of police violence at that point, and it was just so special, like, to have so many people living together outside on the land, and everybody's job just to be taking care of each other, and figuring out how to make this work, and people who were being in charge of cleaning porta potties and people who were being in charge of setting up the kitchen and feeding everyone and chopping wood. And so it was just really, really incredible. And I feel really lucky to have been a guest there.
We're going to talk about your book, of course, but I'm wondering about these words, because you work with words and think deeply, especially in poetry, about the meaning of every word. And that is the difference between the word protest and protector.
Yeah.
Protester and protector. That was talked about a lot at the time. Is this a mass protest that these people say we're water protectors?
Yeah.
Does that matter?
Yeah. I mean, I always want to acknowledge that I'm white and I'm a guest in the movement, and so I want to be cautious about how I speak for other people, But Yeah, you know, I mean, I think what people are saying, right, is like, this is our homeland. This is this water. We've had this long-standing, you know, forever relationship with, right? Mm-hmm. And we are here to take care of this water. You know, we're not just standing up against something. We're here because this is this water that we love, and this is this land that we love, and we're here to protect it, to take care of it.
So I'm asking that question as someone mm-hmm. who's white, because you write this book, and you say in the introduction, yours is only a small corner of the story, and you direct people to many Indigenous voices you think that they should read. Mm-hmm. But in your corner, because there were many white people who did come and participate, and I'm wondering for you,
yeah,
were you thinking of yourself as a educator, as a protester, as a protector ally? What did you think you were doing as a white person going to the place and staying there?
Yeah, that is such a good question, Lori. Thank you for asking that. A little bit all of the above, maybe, you know, I definitely was very aware the whole time that I, you know, was a guest there. Elena invited me to stay, and I took that really seriously, you know, and really seriously as a responsibility, you know, to live there in relationship and to think about what that means, right, to be white in this mm-hmm. movement space, in this very Indigenous Lakota movement space. And also, of course, yes, I was there for 5 months. You know, I mean, I was there because I believed in what was happening and believe in it, you know, in protecting the water, in an Indigenous sovereignty of the land. One of the things that really I learned a lot about from, you know, from my friends and from the camp community, specifically my friend Kimimila Locke, who I collaborate with a lot, is just about thinking about myself as a relative all the time, you know, and I think that that is something for me. Like, I have really moved away from the word ally, because I think that sometimes sounds like this, like, hat we can take on and off, right? Like, I can be an ally when I choose to be an ally, right? And I think that, you know, when we think of ourselves as relatives, like, that's a deep commitment to each other that we can't break. And different relatives have different roles in our lives, you know? And I think that it's really important, you know, for me to think of myself as a white relative and know what that means and know that there are boundaries in my work and that I need to listen, you know.
To that point, yeah. The poetry that you write in this book is about your experience. Mm-hmm. You do not inhabit other people's experience and try to speak through them or, you know, imagine yourself into a different role. You are talking about your experience, what you're learning from the children, the games that you're mm-hmm. learning, what the kids are saying, what's happening to you, making decisions about where you're going to put your body and where you're not going to put your body. Mm-hmm. Did you have a sense when you were in the camp that you were going to write about the experience?
I was in grad school for poetry, you know, and so I don't know that I, you know, would have ruled it out. But certainly at the time, I wasn't thinking about it as I'm going to write a book about this, you know. I mean, and things were so busy, you know, again, especially once there was the increase in police violence and people were working so hard all the time to figure out what needed to be done to take better care of each other, to mm-hmm. sustain the camp, to make sure everyone had food and water and was warm. I wasn't like spending long days, you know, at my computer writing. You know, I would take some little notes at night and things like that sometimes to journal to remember, you know, but it wasn't until afterwards that I started to put it into a book,
As a teacher, what sort of experiences were you seeing your students have at the camp?
Everything, you know, I mean, I think that's the thing about the camp is like it was every feeling at once, you know. I mean, I think that sense of community was really, really important for the kids, you know, and it was so beautiful to get to see them, like, you know, have all of these different relationships to go over to the cook shack and help Winona dry corn to make soup for the winter and to go help, you know, at the medical yurt and, you know, measure herbs and make, you know, fire cider for people's coughs. And they were so much a part of of everything, you know, the places in the camp that were safe for them to be. I think that that's really good for kids and really good for humans, right? to feel integrated into our communities, to know how we can help, to find our roles and to have deep relationships. And then, of course, also, you know, sometimes the camp was a scary place, not because of the camp itself, but because of, you know, what was coming from the state and what was coming from the police, you know. So there was certainly, like, kids asking questions about tear gas, you know, and kids asking, like, do the police arrest kids? Like, are they going to come to my teepee at night and things like that, you know? And so I think that, I don't know, everything about the camp, there was so much just intense beauty and care. And I think that's something we don't always see about activist spaces, you know, is I think between the big moments of frontline things, the ways people are taking care of each other, you know, and that was really important for me to share in the book, too.
Is there a poem that we can pause and you might read for us that illustrates something like that? What comes up for you?
Yeah. We end up at a buffalo butchering after the Halloween party. Two men struggle, pull at the hide where its belly is slit like a seam, constellate the thick fur with their headlamps, small beside the crude oil spotlights that bleach the sky of stars now. A woman with a purple bandana slices the membrane, exposed, thin as moon. The animal pops apart, knob-kneed, leg flung toward the kids, shivering in my lap. RJ whispers, Pilama yaye tatanka for the stew and the taco meat. We nod, polyester ninja suits and tiger tails dampening in the grass, Snicker wrappers circling us like rocks around a fire. 3 days since treaty camp was raided. Since I drove them in circles all night past dark teepees and empty trailers, past ambulances clustered like a scab by the waving flag road, all of us eating trunk stale Oreos and dry ramen, crooning too loud to some song nobody liked. Everyone knew better than to ask for their family. I'm a zombie still. Or half of one anyway, in dollar store makeup done up by the girls. Shawnee Ray holds my face in her hands, delicate as if I'm a bundle of bird bones. Dabs baby wipes at the green sludge beneath my eyes, the blood on my mouth. The buffalo's fat frosted muscle glistens now, runs in streams, the animal red and hideless in the too bright night. We look like that inside, Shawnee pauses to say. RJ says, in the old days they killed them with bows, but now they use guns. Shalina shakes her head. No, only cops have those.
Thank you for that. There's times when, you know, you're leaving your own life behind to be here and you hadn't planned to be there for as long as you ended up staying. What was it like to step outside of a traditional American life and do this for an extended period of time?
Yeah.
There's a strain.
I mean, I think, you know, I was actually just talking to someone the other day who was at the Line 3 camps for a period of time, you know, and we were both saying to each other, like, I just didn't know people could take care of each other like this, you know, which again, I know I keep saying it, but really that was, you know, especially in the beginning, like, that was astounding for me. You know, I was like, oh, this is the way we're supposed to be human. You know, like, we're not supposed to be living in tiny boxes apart from each other, right? We're supposed to be this interdependent on each other. We're supposed to be checking in on each other. We're supposed to be thinking about what everyone needs, you know? And so I think that that piece of it was just mind-blowing in terms of being like, who do I want to be as a person? And then I think also, like you said, like, it was also a strain sometimes, right? was very lucky to have so many people in my life who were very, very supportive. You know, my husband, who also is involved with the camp, he's a lawyer and has been doing a civil rights case about the camp as well. And he was very supportive of me being there most of the time. It was strange to feel like my life kind of turned into these two different lives. You know, it was very disorienting in that way.
And now, these years later.
Yeah.
Are you still living two different lives? Have you gone back to life A?
I mean, anyone who's been through a really intense experience, I think, can relate to this, right? Like this sort of like figuring out how to sort of take what your life was before and, you know.
Before and this after.
Right, yeah. Right. And, you know, it really took me a while, I think, to figure that out, you know, to return to my apartment in St. Louis at that time and kind of walk around and be like, I have lights. I have a bed. I should finish my grad school work. You know, I'm going to cook for myself and be alone, you know. Yeah. So it was really strange.
Because then you go through the pandemic.
Right.
So you have this experience at Standing Rock that had to have informed your experience of the isolation of the pandemic, too.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think I have figured out any kind of magic answer for how to, you know. But I do think that the experience did really change my thinking about how I wanted to be a person, you know, and I've tried in whatever ways I can to live up to what I learned, you know, and to think about how do my actions take care of people and also how do I accept being taken care of, right? Because that's an important part of it too.
Is poetry part of that answer?
Yeah, I think so for me, you know. I mean, I think I needed to write this collection really also just to do what we were talking about, right? To kind of figure out, okay, what do I do now? And to process, you know, again, I want to always acknowledge that it's, you know, that land is not my homeland, you know, and I know that the experience of what happened is different for people who it is, you know, whose homelands those are. It was really confusing. I also, you know, had been there for so long and so many people had given up so much to be there, so much more than me, you know, and figuring out how to process the fact that we knew the pipeline was going to go through, you know, that this was going to happen. And what did this movement mean? You know, what did it mean for me as an individual? You know, I think that was for me a really important part of writing this collection is to kind of try to work through that.
Yeah. 10 years later. Did we succeed? Did we fail?
Yeah.
What were we doing? What resonates today? Mm-hmm. And all of that is in, I think, the poetry. Those big questions. Being unafraid. I think it's one of the things that resonates for me about your collection is that it is unafraid to grapple with some of those big questions about what it means to be outside of your regular life doing this thing and what it means to be in community when bad things happen and to ask of ourselves, what are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
And does it matter?
Yeah.
Would you read one more for us?
Sure. January after camp. Listen, I don't want to keep touching the interior of my house. Want to stop leaning in the stairwell, tapping each exposed brick one by one, mortar coating my fingers like lunar dust. I want to stop running, my finger along the edge of the formica table, flipping the lights on and off and on and off and off and off. No, I don't want to talk about it. But could you give me a word for the opposite of a miracle? What if the fish stopped dividing before everyone was fed, or the Red Sea contracted on the final stragglers? What do we say now that the camp is disappearing and the pipeline isn't? What do I call this warm bed and phone signal, this house where I'm not needed to chop wood or find breakfast, to walk with the kids along the river? The doctors say I'm here until spring. My herniated spine, a boat that's left me on this shore. Back at camp, they're disassembling the yurt, pulling down each pole that held our small sky, packing the never-finished books the kids were writing into whatever boxes they can find. What if I don't see any options besides being there or pretending it never happened? A magazine tells me on Mount Sinai, scientists have discovered a way to read a palimpsest, written over stories still legible in their depressions. They tell me what's beautiful or terrible can never be erased. And I close the pages, let the battery drain on my phone, open the amber bottles of pills that sometimes let me forget the pain long enough to sit in a chair a minute or two, walk unassisted to the kitchen, the bathroom. I wear my boots to watch TV, white-knuckled, clutching a throw pillow like a steering wheel. I'm home. My husband tells me to take off my coat.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
If there was a piece of advice that you could give yourself from the future, the day you walk into the camp for the first time.
Oh, Lori.
nothing else is going to change, but you can go back and talk to her on day one and say, pay attention to this. Remember this. What would it be?
Oh, gosh, that's such a good question. I mean, I think just to keep noticing the beauty and the joy, even at the times that things were the hardest, right? To hold on to that, you know, and to I don't know, it's so easy when things are really scary and things are really hard. You know, you have to think about that, right? Like you have to notice that. And also, if you let that be all you notice, you lose what's most important, right? You lose, you know. And so I think that, you know, to keep appreciating the kids and to keep appreciating the community and to never lose sight that that's something that nobody can take, right?
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's Teresa Zeglowitz. She's an educator and a poet. She's also the recipient of a Pushcart Prize, a Best New Poets Award, and an Academy of American Poets Prize. Her book is called Something Small of How to See a River. And that's our conversation for today. We hope that it served you. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.